The goals of the Kennedy brothers were both noble and politically pragmatic: to bring democracy to Cuba while also keeping the volatile issue of Cuba and whether all the Soviet missiles had really been removed out of the 1964 elections. Kennedy aides told me something later confirmed by a declassified memo. JFK wanted to keep Cuba from becoming a political football during the 1964 campaign, which would begin in January 1964. That meant they had to take action before the end of 1963, preferably at least a month before the Christmas holidays. It's critical to point out that for the JFK-Almeida coup plan to have worked, Commander Almeida could not take public responsibility for Fidel's death, and neither could Williams or the other Cuban exiles. The Cuban populace could hardly be expected to rally around new leaders who boasted of having killed Fidel, whom the CIA admitted was still admired by many on the island. Thus, Williams told me, someone else would take the fall for Fidel's death. Williams said he had no involvement with finding the fall guy, that Robert Kennedy was handling that with the CIA. Evidence gleaned from CIA memos and coup plan files indicates that Fidel's death would have been blamed on a Russian or a Russian sympathizer, a way to help neutralize the thousands of Soviet personnel still in Cuba. Many newspaper accounts noted increasing tension between Fidel and the Soviets in the second half of 1963. As head of the army, Almeida knew the locations of all Soviet forces in Cuba, as well as Fidel's security plans. Almeida had enough personal prestige that if he went on Cuban TV and announced that their beloved Fidel had been killed by a Russian or Russian sympathizer, the Cuban people would accept his word, the same way most U.S. citizens at that time would accept a pronouncement by a trusted figure such as J. Edgar Hoover. In addition, Commander Almeida was the highest black official in a country estimated to be 70% of African descent. So it was felt the populace would more easily rally around him than someone like the Argentinian Che Guevara, struggling as an economic bureaucrat in 1963, or one of the white Cuban officials the Russians might back. It's important to stress that as the months progressed, the Kennedys constantly looked for a peaceful alternative to what one memo called a potentially bloody coup. Yet they also continued to make increasingly detailed plans to overthrow Fidel. As discussed in later chapters, by fall the Kennedys were pursuing two different, secret, peace feelers, trying to jumpstart peace talks with Castro. When Secretary of State Dean Rusk confirmed the existence of the coup plan to Vanity Fair in 1994, the article's authors asked Rusk about the Kennedys' attempts to negotiate with Castro at the same time they were planning a coup against him. In pursuing two strategies at the same time, Rusk admits that the Kennedys were playing with fire. Rusk told Vanity Fair, "Oh, there's no particular contradiction there. It was just an either-or situation." That went on frequently. JFK's earlier noted comments to John McCone reflect this dual strategy, as does Robert Kennedy's oral history at Boston's John F. Kennedy Presidential Library. RFK said, "There were some tentative peace feelers that were put out by Castro which were accepted by us." But in the very next sentence, RFK adds that at the same time, "We were also making more of an effort against Castro through espionage in August, September, October 1963. It was better organized than it had been before, and was having quite an effect." In what may be an oblique reference to the coup, RFK says that one of his goals was internal uprisings, and that "we were more than just assisting because of his contact with some of those people." Pursuing peace and war at the same time also reflected the indecisiveness of the American public about Cuba. JFK biographer Richard Reeves notes that 60% of Americans in 1963 thought Castro was a serious threat to world peace, yet a slightly higher percentage were against sending United States troops to invade Castro's island. Given the decades of secrecy surrounding the JFK-Almeida coup plan, it's shocking that a dozen associates of Carlos Marcello, Trafficante, or Rosselli knew about, and in seven cases actually worked on, the top-secret operation. Learning about the coup plan gave Marcello's group the deadly secret it needed to prevent a full and public investigation of JFK's murder, if the effort to overthrow Fidel could be linked to JFK's murder. In addition, as plans for the coup and invasion progressed, there was also a chance that phony evidence implicating Fidel in JFK's death could trigger a U.S. invasion of Cuba, one that the U.S. military had been preparing for months. John and Robert Kennedy tried to bar the Mafia from any participation in the coup plan that included keeping the Mafia out of Cuba after the coup's hoped-for success, when the mob would not be allowed to reopen their casinos. Unfortunately, declassified files show that several associates of Carlos Marcello not only knew about the secret plan, but made documented comments about this otherwise top-secret operation. An FBI report written just weeks after JFK's assassination quotes Jack Ruby as talking about something he must have learned before being jailed for shooting Oswald. According to the memo, Ruby talked about an invasion of Cuba that was being sponsored by the United States government. That long-overlooked remark wasn't in the Warren report, but it was included in the 26 volumes of supporting evidence and documents that the Warren Commission issued. To most in the Bureau and on the Warren Commission, and later to the relative few who read the 26 volumes, such a claim undoubtedly seemed absurd. But they didn't realize that JFK's no-invasion pledge regarding Cuba had ever taken effect, and that the United States government really had been planning an invasion of Cuba. Those plans were withheld not only from the Warren Commission, but also from the House Select Committee on Assassinations and all other congressional investigating committees. Remarkably, as detailed in the next chapter, Ruby was just one of 12 associates of Carlos Marcello, Traficante, or Rosselli who knew important information about the JFK-Almeida coup plan. Even more remarkable, seven associates of the Mafia chiefs were actually working on parts of the coup invasion plan, even though John and Robert Kennedy had banned the Mafia from having anything to do with the operation. FBI files show that Marcello's pilot, David Ferry, knew about the second invasion planned for Cuba, the Bay of Pigs being the first. According to an FBI memo, a close associate of Ferry told the FBI about Ferry's dealings with the late Attorney General Robert Kennedy and plans for a Cuban second invasion. Guy Bannister, Marcello's private detective, knew about the coup plan as well. A close friend of Bannister, likely using information from the detective, even wrote an account in the summer of 1963 that described secret Kennedy administration planning for Cuba in which Castro would be the fall guy in a complete reorganization for the Cuban regime, which will then be free of Soviet influence. Bannister's friend wrote that following Castro's removal, a new government for Cuba would be set up with such men as Manolo Rey, who was one of five exile leaders chosen by RFK and Harry Williams to be part of the coup plan. According to new witnesses uncovered by Dr. Michael L. Kurtz, John Martino, Santo Traficante's technician, also worked with Carlos Marcello and Guy Bannister in the summer of 1963. Kurtz cites the former superintendent of the New Orleans Police Department as saying that Martino met with Marcello himself at the Town and Country Motel. FBI files cite several accurate descriptions Martino gave of the JFK-Almeida coup plan after JFK's murder, as he taunted the FBI with his knowledge that President Kennedy was engaged in a plot to overthrow the Castro regime by preparing another invasion attempt against Cuba. Martino elaborated on the secret Kennedy scheme in an obscure newspaper article contained in an FBI file not released until 1998. In it, Martino is quoted as saying, 2 months after JFK's death, that when he died, Kennedy was embarked on a plan to get rid of Castro. There was to be another invasion and uprising in Cuba. Martino accurately noted that since the death of Kennedy, the work on an invasion has virtually stopped. He even mentioned that, according to Kennedy's plan, after the coup, the Organization of American States would be involved until an election could be set up. The OAS role, as detailed in several of the 14 drafts of the top-secret plan for a coup in Cuba, drawn up under Robert Kennedy's direction in the summer and fall of 1963, wasn't declassified until 1997. Yet Marcello's associate Martino knew about that, and more, decades earlier. Even Lee Oswald, who had connections to Marcello documented earlier, made an interesting remark about an invasion of Cuba by the United States at a time when almost no one was publicly speculating about such an operation. A long-overlooked New York Times article even quotes a Cuban exile who had contact with Oswald in New Orleans in August 1963 and who knew David Ferry, as saying that Lee H. Oswald had boasted about what he would do if the United States attempted an invasion of Cuba. In the summer of 1963, Oswald, accompanied by David Ferry, reportedly visited a training camp near New Orleans that was affiliated with Manuel Artime, one of the key exile leaders for the JFK Almeida coup plan. CIA memos I first published in 2005 confirm that in the early 1960s, Manuel Artime was also working on the CIA mafia plots, which also involved Traficante, Rosselli, and Marcello. Artime, E. Howard Hunt's best friend, would soon become part of Traficante's drug trafficking network. Artime was one of seven associates of the three mob bosses who were actually working on the JFK Almeida coup plan. The same is true for Tony Verona, the first Cuban exile leader to join Harry Williams' operation, all while he was still working with Santo Traficante and Johnny Rosselli on the CIA mafia plots. It was their work on those unauthorized plots that allowed some of the mob boss's men to infiltrate the Kennedy brothers' authorized operation, the JFK Almeida coup plan. E. Howard Hunt has long been the subject of speculation and congressional investigations regarding his possible involvement in JFK's murder, though evidence remains elusive, as explained in the book's final chapter. Even Hunt's taped confession isn't really a confession at all, but an account full of recycled and debunked theories, speculation, and important omissions, such as the mafia ties of his best friend, Artime, and his longtime assistant, Bernard Barker. However, Barker was definitely involved in JFK's murder, according to Harry Williams, RFK's friend and aide for the JFK Almeida coup plan. Long before files linking Barker to organized crime were declassified, Williams told me and my research associate that Barker had worked for Traficante and was doing so in 1963, at the same time Barker was working on the JFK Almeida coup plan. As Williams explained to me, E. Howard Hunt was one of two prominent CIA officers assigned to assist Harry Williams. Kennedy aides, former FBI agent William Turner, and Vanity Fair all confirmed Hunt's work with Williams. Williams detailed to me, and to William Turner, the important role Barker played as Hunt's assistant in 1963, something Barker himself indicated in published interviews. Many of Barker's 1963 CIA files, including all those involving his admitted work as Hunt's assistant that year, remain unreleased. However, quoted earlier was a Barker CIA memo that slipped through. It mentioned a coup plot against Fidel involving Commander Almeida. In a 1970s TV documentary, Barker said, "At the time of the Kennedy assassination, President Kennedy's government had reached its peak in its efforts to overthrow Castro, something not reflected in any history books or government reports at the time Barker made his comments." Harry Williams said there were dozens of meetings from May to November 1963 with E. Howard Hunt and a CIA security officer assigned to the operation. Bernard Barker arranged those meetings, most of them held away from Miami. Barker was Hunt's assistant, very close to Hunt, Williams explained. As the JFK Almeida coup plan progressed, Barker assisted Hunt with two of the most sensitive parts of the plan. Barker helped Hunt with the covert payment of $50,000 to Commander Almeida through a foreign bank, the initial installment of an agreed-upon total sum of $500,000, more than $3 million today. Robert Kennedy had authorized the money in the event the coup was unsuccessful and Almeida had to flee Cuba. If he was killed, the money would alternatively provide for his wife and two children. Barker was well suited for such a financial role, since one of his jobs before the Bay of Pigs invasion was to deliver CIA cash laundered through foreign banks. Secondly, Barker and Hunt were also part of a covert operation in which Almeida's wife and two children left Cuba on a seemingly innocent pretext prior to the date set for the coup. The plan was for Almeida's family to wait out the coup safely in another country, under secret CIA surveillance. RFK had also authorized Williams and the CIA to assure Almeida that if anything happened to him and his family couldn't return to Cuba, his family would be taken care of. In addition to providing for their safety, having the family in another country under the watchful eye of the CIA also ensured that Almeida didn't double-cross the CIA and the Kennedys. Even Barker's routine CIA reports from the summer and fall of 1963 that have been declassified, the ones that don't mention Hunt show him submitting a stream of information linked either to the mob or the coup plan. For example, Barker filed reports about a meeting between Manuel Artime and Tony Verona to discuss unity, and noting Artime's meeting with Traficante bagman Frank Fiorini in Dallas to buy an airplane. Barker's CIA reports also mention Eloy Manoyo's plan to overthrow Fidel and the operations of Manolo Rey. Barker also reported on the efforts of Sam Benton, another private detective working for Carlos Marcello, to recruit an American mercenary, part of the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel. The mercenary backed out when he learned that an associate of Johnny Rosselli was involved in the plot. In 1963, Harry Williams and Robert Kennedy didn't know that Barker was connected to Santo Traficante, as he later learned. Williams was not privy to FBI and CIA files released decades later tying Barker to the mob. Nor did he realize that his associates Tony Verona and Manuel Artime also had ties to Traficante. The JFK Almeida coup plan gave Marcello and Traficante the opportunity they needed to kill JFK in a way that would prevent even Robert Kennedy, as well as Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover, from pursuing a full or public investigation of the murder. Though the Kennedys had tried to bar the mafia from any knowledge of or participation in the coup plan, the network of Marcello and Traficante surrounding the CIA mafia Castro plots allowed the mob bosses to use Barker, Verona, and others to infiltrate the coup plan and ultimately link it to JFK's assassination. 12 years after JFK's murder, Richard Helms tried to explain to congressional investigators why he continued the CIA mafia plots in 1963 without telling President Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, or CIA Director John McCone. In his long secret testimony to the Senate Church Committee in 1975, Helms hinted at the JFK Almeida coup plan, which the CIA withheld from the committee, saying that President Kennedy mentioned the desire to have the military of some force inside Cuba rise up against Castro, some internal revolt. Helms went off the record with the committee counsel, who then summarized, "In June of 1963, President Kennedy approved a program that also involved the promoting of disaffection among the Cuban military hierarchy." Helms indicated then, and in later testimony, that he saw no difference between that effort and hiring the mafia to assassinate Fidel. To Helms, having mobsters shoot Fidel so he could be replaced by a right-wing dictator, perhaps someone like Manuel Artime, best friend of his protege Hunt, was no different from, and perhaps even preferable to, helping an internal coup that would be followed by a coalition government, free elections, and democracy. Kennedy aides and officials, including Secretary of State Rusk, told me they totally disagree with Helms' view. Historian Gerald McKnight talked about the CIA's culture of arrogance, assumed privileged insights, and special understanding, in which the agency believed it knew the requirements of national security better than the transient elected officials to whom the CIA was nominally accountable. McKnight was writing about CIA officer William Harvey, but his description also applies to Richard Helms, whom history now shows withheld crucial information from JFK, LBJ, who made Helms CIA director, and Richard Nixon, who finally fired Helms after he refused for years to show Nixon the CIA files he wanted. That arrogant attitude is apparently why Helms continued the CIA mafia plots even after the JFK Almeida coup plan was far along. William Harvey was replaced as head of Cuban operations after his unauthorized raids into Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Officially, his replacement, early in 1963, was Desmond Fitzgerald, a patrician figure from a family even wealthier and more blue-blooded than that of Richard Helms. Fitzgerald was brought over from Far Eastern operations and had no previous experience in Cuban affairs. Perhaps for that reason, William Harvey continued to work with Johnny Rosselli on the CIA mafia plots. Harvey had also grown close to Rosselli, but his role with the mafia don had to end in June 1963, when the FBI learned that Rosselli was visiting Harvey. However, after the FBI learned of the June meeting between Rosselli and Harvey, the CIA assigned Rosselli to a new contact, David Morales, the Miami operations chief. A gruff, powerful, and forceful man of Southwestern Native American descent, Morales had headed covert operations for the CIA in Havana before the closing of the U.S. Embassy, where he had supervised David Atlee Phillips. Morales also had a role in the Bay of Pigs operation and was extremely bitter at its tragic outcome, which he blamed exclusively on President Kennedy. The number two official at the Miami CIA station bluntly described Morales, "If the U.S. government needed someone or something neutralized, they would do it, including things that were repugnant to a lot of people." Former U.S. diplomat Wayne Smith, who worked with Morales at the U.S. Embassy in Havana, said that, "If Morales were in the mob, he'd be called a hitman." Johnny Rosselli, always looking for an advantage to exploit, soon turned the hard-drinking David Morales into a close friend. They even took a trip to Las Vegas together. For Rosselli, Morales was just another CIA agent he could use for his own ends, in this case, the JFK assassination. While Barker was helpful, he was only a CIA agent. But Morales was a high-ranking CIA officer who could control operations, who could order weapons shipped, and who was also working on the JFK Almeida coup plan. Like Rosselli, David Morales would eventually confess, late in life, to having a role in the murder of JFK. Morales made his confession to his attorney, and also to a lifelong friend, after going on a tirade about JFK's sole responsibility for the failure of the Bay of Pigs. Morales said he had to watch all the men he had recruited and trained get wiped out because of Kennedy. Morales then told his friends that, "We took care of that son of a bitch, JFK." Congressional investigator Gaetan Fonzi, who worked for both the Senate Church Committee and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, uncovered Morales' JFK confession and found it credible. In the fall of 1963, Morales and Rosselli were observed working closely together. An Army Ranger assigned to the CIA in the summer and fall of 1963 later wrote an account of his time in South Florida training Cuban exiles. He wrote about a Colonel Rosselli, who also worked with one of the exile groups, saying that Rosselli's team included a sharpshooter who did daily marksmanship practice, rehearsing for the day when he could center the crosshairs of this telescopic sight on Fidel. Rosselli's sharpshooter was able to kill three cormorants at a range of nearly 500 yards. Apparently, the CIA was preparing to have shooters available to kill Fidel if Almeida had problems finding someone to eliminate the Cuban leader. The Army Ranger also documented Rosselli's work with David Morales at the time. Given the JFK confessions of Rosselli and Morales, some researchers have wondered if their sharpshooter and advanced sniper weapons were intended only for Fidel Castro. Carlos Marcello's access to the highly secret CIA mafia plots and those working on the JFK Almeida coup plan gave the Godfather and his allies, Traficante and Rosselli, the connections he needed to create grave concerns at the highest levels of the U.S. government if those plans appeared linked to JFK's murder. From August to November, Marcello and his men would move to compromise more key elements of the coup plan and other covert CIA operations as part of their plot to kill JFK. Chapter 10. Plans to assassinate Fidel Castro and President Kennedy. Throughout the summer and fall of 1963, CIA Deputy Director for Plans Richard Helms juggled an array of authorized and unauthorized covert attempts to eliminate Fidel Castro. All of them would impact JFK's assassination. The authorized operations included JFK's coup plan with Cuban Army Commander Juan Almeida, and two far less successful efforts to identify Cuban military officers willing to lead a coup against Fidel. A CIA operation named M-Trunk and a joint CIA Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, task force. In addition, several exile leaders in the JFK-Almeida coup plan continued to attempt tiny raids into Cuba or against Cuban ships. Minor efforts designed to keep the pot boiling, in the words of one official, until the day for Almeida's coup arrived. Those raids also kept up the morale of Cuban exiles still receiving U.S. funding, since only a handful of their leaders knew about Commander Almeida and the coup. In addition to all those efforts, in the remaining months of 1963, Richard Helms actually increased his use of unauthorized operations designed to simply assassinate Fidel Castro. All his unauthorized assassination plots involved mafia associates, so Helms may have viewed them as simply different aspects of one operation, the same CIA mafia plots that had been running for 3 years. Also, based on his later congressional testimony, Helms apparently saw no real distinction between his CIA mafia plots and the Kennedys' authorized efforts to stage a coup against Fidel. As Helms would testify to Senate investigators in 1975, "I believe it was the policy at the time to get rid of Castro, and if killing him was one of the things that was to be done in this connection, that was within what was expected." If true, that belief doesn't explain why Helms kept President Kennedy, CIA Director McCone, and Attorney General Robert Kennedy in the dark about his unauthorized operations, or why he used mobsters the Attorney General was trying to prosecute. The most generous view of the actions of Richard Helms and a handful of his subordinates in deceiving his superiors would be that Helms viewed the CIA mafia plots as a kind of backup plan in case something happened to Commander Almeida before he launched the coup. Helms might have seen the CIA mafia plots as a way of salvaging the operation in the event that Commander Almeida lost his position, was injured, imprisoned, or killed, or decided to flee prior to the coup. Helms might have thought that even if Almeida could initiate the coup, it would still be helpful to have mafia or exile sharpshooters on hand to finish the job, just in case anything went wrong. While the CIA had only a supporting role in the JFK-Almeida coup plan, the CIA mafia plots were something that Helms could fully control, or at least he thought he could. Rolando Kubela, an old element of the CIA mafia plots, took on new prominence in the summer of 1963. Kubela, a physician, had headed the Directo Revolucionario, DR, a student group that had helped win the revolution. However, Kubela quickly grew disaffected with Castro rule, and by December 1960, he was working with the CIA on plots to kill Fidel. In many ways, Kubela was simply another part of the CIA mafia plots, since he'd met Santo Traficante in Cuba and knew at least two associates of the Godfather who were also involved in the CIA mafia plots. Kubela had been briefly in touch with the CIA in 1962. In June 1963, the CIA contacted Kubela again, just as David Morales was taking over the supervision of Johnny Rosselli from William Harvey. Although Kubela had no real power within the Cuban government, he received a generous travel budget as the former head of the DR, and he frequently flew to Europe and communist bloc countries. According to Cuban reports, David Morales actually met with Kubela in Paris in September 1963, and the CIA acknowledges that a series of meetings between Kubela and CIA personnel followed. Kubela says the CIA kept pressuring him to assassinate Fidel, while the CIA claims assassination was Kubela's idea. Rolando Kubela wasn't part of the JFK Almeida coup plan. As JFK's Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, told me, and as CIA files clearly show, he had no following inside Cuba that would have allowed him to stage a coup on his own. For decades, it was thought that Kubela's contacts with the CIA were known only inside the agency, where he was identified as a potential assassin codenamed AMLASH. However, Rusk and another committee member told me that Kubela was discussed by name in some of RFK's Cuba subcommittees of the National Security Council, though not as a possible assassin. Richard Helms and Desmond Fitzgerald mentioned Kubela to some subcommittee members only as someone who might help them find a higher-ranking, more powerful official who could stage a coup. To an official like Rusk, who didn't yet know about Almeida, that sounded reasonable. 12 years later, when Rusk found out that the CIA was actually using Kubela as a potential assassin, he was livid at Helms' deceit, with an anger that the usually calm statesman demonstrated in my interview with him. Only a mid-level official at best, Rolando Kubela played an even smaller role in Cuban affairs as fall 1963 progressed. CIA files established that Kubela lost his ceremonial military title after he resigned from the army after difficulties with Raul Castro, and an October 18, 1963 CIA memo confirms that Kubela has no official position within the government. Yet, Richard Helms and Desmond Fitzgerald increased CIA pressure on Kubela to assassinate Fidel, with Fitzgerald even flying to Paris to confer with Kubela that same month. Though Fitzgerald claimed to be the personal emissary of Robert Kennedy, Helms later admitted that RFK was never told about the meeting or the assassination aspect of the CIA's dealings with Kubela. The CIA admits it tried to persuade Kubela to poison Fidel, but CIA files also show that the Miami CIA station, where David Morales ran operations, was prepared to provide rifles to him. Kubela owned a house next to Fidel's home at Varadero Beach, the resort to which Fidel drove on many weekends in an open jeep in a sort of recreation of his triumphant drive across Cuba after the revolution. AmWorld files indicate that at one point the CIA planned to use snipers to assassinate Fidel as he drove toward his beach house. Clearly, having Fidel's neighbor, Kubela, as part of that plot would be very advantageous. The CIA could use his house as the sniper's nest, and or even blame him for Fidel's murder. Kubela was both a disgruntled official and one who, because of his extensive travels, came in contact with Russians overseas more often than most Cuban officials. Blaming Kubela for Fidel's murder might also let the CIA implicate Russia in Fidel's assassination. Someone in the CIA, most likely David Morales, arranged for Kubela to be in a meeting with his case officer in Paris on November 22, 1963, at the exact time JFK was scheduled to be riding in an open car through Dallas. If Morales arranged that as part of his work with Johnny Rosselli, it was the perfect way to force Helms to hide a great deal of information from internal CIA investigators and other high U.S. officials, which is exactly what happened. Americans would not learn about the Kubela operation until 12 years after JFK's murder, and it was never revealed to the Warren Commission. Richard Helms also approved keeping the CIA's European assassination recruiter, QJ Wynn, on the payroll throughout 1963, despite his released files showing a complete lack of results. William Harvey originally supervised QJ Wynn, but after David Morales took over Harvey's supervision of Johnny Rosselli in June 1963, it's likely that Morales had some role with QJ Wynn as well. The mysterious QJ Wynn was part of the CIA's ZR rifle assassination program. CIA files indicate that ZR rifle had been applied to the Castro problem and that QJ Wynn made a 1963 trip to Florida for an operation involving Johnny Rosselli. However, the ZR rifle program then disappears from the CIA files that have been released, and William Harvey later admitted in Senate testimony that some of his notes about ZR rifle were missing and had been destroyed. As a result, the true identity of QJ Wynn remains unresolved, with various CIA memos and sources giving different names. Files and testimony say that QJ Wynn's job was to recruit assassins from the underworld and that he was involved in narcotics trafficking in Europe in the early 1960s. The CIA files of the European criminal assassins that QJ Wynn tried to recruit, especially those with last names beginning with M, are all heavily censored. Santo Traficante's French Connection heroin associate Michel Victor Mertz has 24 parallels with QJ Wynn. Mertz could have been recruited by QJ Wynn, and or it would have been easy for Mertz to have assumed QJ Wynn's role or clandestine identity. As detailed in an upcoming chapter, declassified files show that Mertz was deported from Dallas soon after JFK's murder, and other evidence implicates him in the crime. Michel Victor Mertz is a little-known but important figure in the JFK plot due to his long ties to Traficante and Marcello's heroin network. It was Mertz who perfected the technique of smuggling heroin hidden in cars on ocean liners, as depicted in the award-winning film The French Connection. Though Mertz was a deadly assassin, he also had ties to French intelligence, the SDECE, and had saved the life of French President Charles de Gaulle in 1961 after infiltrating an anti-de Gaulle group by getting into a fistfight while pretending to be against de Gaulle. Mertz was considered untouchable by French authorities, and he often visited America. He made a trip to Louisiana in 1963 using the alias of an anti-de Gaulle activist who'd had contact with the CIA. In addition to QJ Wynn and the Kubela portions of the CIA mafia plots, Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante, and Johnny Rosselli continued their connections to the Castro assassination plots, though only Rosselli was supposed to be involved. Historians have questioned how much of the mob boss's efforts were really directed at Fidel, and how much those same efforts were part of their plan to kill JFK remains a question. For example, historian Richard Mahoney concluded that, under the CIA penumbra, Rosselli could move guns and assassins in relative secrecy. All experienced murderers seek cover. By putting the agency's fingerprints on mafia operations, the mob could anticipate that the CIA would be forced to cooperate in the cover-up of crucial information related to JFK's assassination. Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli could meet to discuss their plan to assassinate JFK safe from law enforcement surveillance. While Marcello was under pressure from RFK's Justice Department, the New Orleans FBI agent in charge of Marcello claimed the Godfather was merely a lowly tomato salesman who was not involved in organized crime. Marcello was not bugged or wiretapped or closely monitored by the local FBI, so Traficante felt comfortable visiting him in New Orleans. In 1963, Johnny Rosselli visited New Orleans and met with Guy Bannister, according to one of Bannister's secretaries. Mafia protocol makes it almost certain that Mafia Don Rosselli also met with Marcello. In addition, Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli sometimes met at a secluded resort outside Tampa, the Safety Harbor Spa, whose exclusive clientele and distinctive staff freed the mob bosses from any possibility of law enforcement surveillance. As a corollary to RFK's pressure on Rosselli's boss, Sam Giancana, the FBI monitored Rosselli's movements, except when he was on CIA business in Florida. While FBI surveillance reports for Rosselli exist for other times and places, no surveillance reports for his time in Florida in 1963 have yet been released, if they still exist. One reason for the missing records might be Johnny Roselli's meetings with Jack Ruby in Miami in late September and early October 1963. Investigative journalist Scott Malone confirmed that Ruby met secretly with Johnny Roselli in Miami on two occasions in that time span. Malone says that Roselli was under FBI surveillance part of the time, and an FBI agent familiar with the case says that Roselli was indeed in Miami when the meetings with Ruby are supposed to have occurred, and that investigators were able to identify the exact motel rooms where the meetings occurred. When congressional investigator Michael Ewing wrote a meticulously detailed 9-page analysis of Scott Malone's 6-page article after it was released, noting anything even slightly in error, he pointed out no problems with the article's description of the fall 1963 Ruby Roselli meetings in Miami. Notorious Chicago hitman Charles Nicoletti, another member of Roselli's mafia family, also joined the CIA mafia plots in the fall of 1963, according to the Miami Herald and United Press International. A Senate hearing had exposed Nicoletti's 1962 arrest in a specially modified vehicle that the press called a hit car, and that had a hidden compartment behind the front seat that was fitted with brackets to hold shotguns and rifles, and was so large that a machine gun could be secreted in the compartment. Cuban officials and unconfirmed U.S. accounts say that Nicoletti also became part of the mob's plan to kill JFK, as did Herminio Diaz, another mob hitman who worked for Santo Traficante. Diaz had recently left Cuba to join Traficante in Florida. Cuban authorities described him as a hitman since the 1940s, who had tried to assassinate the president of Costa Rica in 1956. In 1963, Diaz began working on the CIA mafia plots for Traficante, and was also of great interest to David Morales' supervisor, Miami CIA Station Chief Ted Shackley. The CIA was especially interested in Diaz because in his first interview in the United States with David Morales' Cuban exile agents, Diaz mentioned Juan Almeida and Rolando Cubela as part of a group of disgruntled Cuban officials who wanted to act against Castro. Diaz had probably acquired the information second or third hand from Traficante or Bernard Barker. But even though Diaz got some of the details wrong, his mention of Almeida and Cubela was enough to get the CIA's attention. Despite another CIA asset's comment that Diaz was fond of gambling and capable of committing any crime for money, the CIA considered using Diaz as an agent candidate or asset. It was important for the success of the mob boss's plot to kill JFK that the trusted men they brought into the plan, Diaz, Charles Nicoletti, Michel Victor Meretz, and John Martino, all had intelligence ties. That gave them cover for their work on the plot, plus ways to feed disinformation to the agencies they worked for before and after JFK's murder. The bosses knew that the agencies might also be reluctant to investigate their own assets, especially when there was someone else who could be blamed. Carlos Marcello was also still involved in the CIA mafia plots in the summer and fall of 1963. Historian Dr. David Kaiser wrote that Marcello had been involved in the CIA mafia plot against Castro from the very beginning and was still working on it into the summer of 1963. At that time, another detective working for Marcello, Sam Benton, assisted in the CIA mafia plots in both Louisiana and Miami. Marcello was also backing Cuban exile groups. The main exile group the Godfather supported was the New Orleans branch of Tony Verona's Cuban Revolutionary Council, which also involved David Ferry. The Cuban Revolutionary Council had originally been organized by E. Howard Hunt with the assistance of Bernard Barker. Verona, Hunt, and Barker were now working on the JFK-Almeida coup plan with Harry Williams, while also continuing to work on the CIA mafia plots. It's easy to see how the lines become blurred between the covert Cuban operations that JFK and the CIA director had authorized and the unauthorized operations Richard Helms was hiding from them. Helms may not have minded the crossover. He might have even welcomed it, since it gave him cover if problems arose with his unauthorized operations. It was probably also easier for him to manage the operations by using some of the same personnel, such as Morales, Fitzgerald, Barker, Artime, and Kubela, on both the authorized and unauthorized activities. Unfortunately, that also gave the mob bosses access to potentially compromise each exile component of the JFK Almeida coup plan. In addition to Harry Williams, the exiles' leaders the Kennedys wanted for their operation were Artime, Verona, Manolo Rey, and Eloy Menoyo. The mob bosses attempted to link each to either the CIA mafia plots or to Lee Oswald in the summer and fall of 1963. And they often succeeded. The Mafia's effort to intimidate, buy off, or kill Harry Williams began in the summer of 1963. Kennedy aides and Robert Kennedy's phone logs agree that Harry Williams sometimes stayed at Robert Kennedy's New York apartment, as Williams undertook extensive travels for RFK. On one occasion, in 1963, former Death Squad leader Rolando Masferrer, accompanied by two thugs described as looking like mafia torpedoes, confronted Williams there. Masferrer was an associate of both Santo Traficante and John Martino. Masferrer insisted on joining Williams' operation, but knowing the Kennedys had banned Masferrer from receiving U.S. backing, Williams refused to be intimidated. Masferrer left. Next, Traficante tried to bribe Williams. Bernard Barker had apparently arranged for Williams to meet with the CIA security officer for the JFK Almeida coup plan at a Miami restaurant. During the meeting, the CIA officer excused himself, and Williams was called over to the table of Santo Traficante, who offered Williams a bribe. Williams declined, and when the CIA officer returned, the agency man made no mention of Traficante or the bribe. Since Williams resisted intimidation and bribery, Traficante tried one final approach. Later in the summer of 1963, Williams traveled to Guatemala City to confer with Manuel Artime, a trip that Barker had also likely helped arrange. While Williams dined at a restaurant that night before the scheduled meeting, two gunmen attacked him. He barely escaped after shooting one of them. Back in his hotel, Williams immediately called RFK. The Attorney General told him to leave the country as soon as possible. It's important to note that Williams was in touch with the FBI before and after the incident. Bureau agents had warned Williams to be careful, which is why he was carrying a pistol. But Williams' FBI file, like his CIA file, has never been released. The few memos about Williams released in other documents prove that his FBI and CIA files in 1963 alone would have been quite extensive, given the high-profile people he met with. As mentioned earlier, a summer 1963 CIA memo says that exile leader Tony Verona was bribed with $200,000, more than $1 million today, from Roselli's boss Giancana. The CIA learned of the bribe from Mafia member Richard Kane, who had been involved in the CIA Mafia plots since 1960. After bugging a communist embassy in Mexico City the previous year, Kane began working for the CIA as an asset in the summer of 1963, while he was also chief investigator for the Chicago Cook County Sheriff. CIA memos later withheld from congressional investigators show that Kane's information about Tony Verona traveled via an unusually secure channel directly to Desmond Fitzgerald, the CIA official working closely with Richard Helms. That secure channel to Fitzgerald and Helms would also soon be used to convey troubling information about Lee Oswald. However, at the time of Verona's bribe, perhaps CIA officials like Helms saw nothing wrong with the payment, since Verona, Giancana, and Kane had all been working for the CIA on the CIA Mafia plots. But after JFK's murder, Verona's Mafia bribe would be yet another explosive piece of information that Helms would have to hide from his own CIA director. The agency also had in its files incriminating remarks Verona made to former Death Squad leader Rolando Masferrer just weeks after Verona received his $200,000 bribe. In the late summer of 1963, Verona ominously told Masferrer that he would help remove certain obstacles preventing Masferrer from getting U.S. backing, something possible only if JFK was no longer president. Manuel Artime, E. Howard Hunt's good friend, was called by some exiles the CIA's golden boy. His part of the JFK Almeida coup plan was so important that the CIA assigned it a separate codename, M-World, and its own super-secure communications network at the Miami CIA station. Congressional investigators later documented the lavish support the CIA gave Artime. 4 bases, 2 in Costa Rica and 2 in Nicaragua, with 2 large ships, 8 small vessels, 2 speedboats, 3 planes, and more than 200 tons of weapons and armaments and about $250,000 in electronic equipment. Unlike Verona, Artime was probably not a knowing participant in the plan to kill JFK. In the late 1970s, shortly before Artime's death, congressional investigator Gaetan Fonzi received information that Artime had guilty knowledge of the crime, but that could have come after JFK's murder. Artime received so much support from the CIA and the Kennedys, and was slated for such a major role in Cuba if the coup succeeded, that he would seem to have nothing to gain by helping to kill JFK before the coup. However, CIA files withheld from Congress make it clear that not only was Artime working on the CIA mafia plot, but the CIA looked at using the mafia to provide cover for all the weapons it was providing to Artime. Those agency memos also show that the CIA was well aware of the talk of mafia activity that swirled around Artime. Artime's operations were further compromised when they were linked to Lee Oswald. In the summer of 1963, David Ferry reportedly took Oswald to a small training camp outside of New Orleans that supplied recruits for Artime's camps in Central America. The mafia would also try to compromise liberal exile leader Manolo Rey, whose reputation for integrity seemed to render him incorruptible. Traficante and Marcello's men thus took an indirect approach to tie Lee Oswald to Rey and his exile group. In the late summer of 1963, Oswald appears to have made an unusual visit to Silvia Odio, a female member of Rey's group in Dallas. Odio's father was in prison in Cuba because of a Castro assassination attempt by Alpha 66's Antonio Veciana. With no advance notice, an American and 2 Cuban exiles appeared at the door of Odio's Dallas apartment. The American was introduced to her as Leon Oswald. Both Odio and her sister saw the 3 men. The day after the unusual visit, one of the exiles phoned Odio to make the provocative claim that Oswald was a former Marine, an expert marksman who said the exiles should have assassinated Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. More than 2 months later, after the JFK assassination, both Silvia Odio and her sister recognized Oswald during TV coverage. Gaetan Fonzi extensively investigated and documented the Oswald-Odio meeting, finding Odio and her sister's account very credible. The provocative visit appears to have been engineered with the assistance of 2 Traficante associates, John Martino, who'd met Odio's sister in Dallas, and Rolando Masferrer, whose brother lived in Odio's apartment complex. It was another example of explosive information, information that would cause problems for investigators and intelligence agencies when it surfaced, being planted months before JFK's murder. Indeed, Odio's story would cause major last-minute problems for the Warren Commission until an associate of Traficante, Lauren Hall, indicated that it was he and his friends who made the visit, not Oswald. However, after the Warren report was published, Hall denied making the visit. One by one, Marcello, Traficante, and their men attempted to compromise or link to JFK's upcoming murder The handful of Cuban exile leaders and groups involved in the JFK Almeida coup plan. What they did to link exile leader Eloy Menoyo's group to Oswald is described later in this book. As for Trafficante and Marcello, their motivation to kill JFK only increased during the summer and early fall of 1963. New developments in their cases help explain their extensive and careful plans to assassinate the president. Trafficante was fighting the IRS, the same organization that had sent Al Capone to prison, and three of his brothers were also named in the IRS complaint. Marcello faced an upcoming federal trial in New Orleans. The Justice Department attorney presenting the case against him would be one of RFK's own mafia prosecutors, meaning this was one trial that Marcello couldn't buy his way out of with bribes to local or state authorities. Any conviction could result in another deportation, and Marcello was still scarred with the memory of that traumatic experience. Marcello was not alone among mob bosses in his hatred of John and Robert Kennedy. Though the FBI had not wiretapped Marcello's phones and had placed only one minor wiretap on Trafficante, RFK's pressure had resulted in the FBI's wiretapping other mob leaders, who vented their rage at the Kennedys. Bureau agents heard one Philadelphia mobster complain, "With Kennedy, a guy should take a knife and stab and kill that fucker. I mean it." The mob chief of Buffalo went even further, saying of the Kennedys, they should kill the whole family. Marcello differed from them in two ways. He had more to lose, more quickly, from the Kennedys' assault. And because Marcello headed America's oldest mafia family, he didn't need approval from the other bosses on the National Mafia Commission before pursuing major hits, like killing JFK. Jimmy Hoffa appears to have been aware of Marcello and Trafficante's plan to kill JFK, but he couldn't take an active role because of the intense scrutiny he was under from Robert Kennedy's Justice Department. Hoffa was being investigated and eventually charged on three fronts. Basically, in the words of historian David Kaiser, involving his use of union funds, particularly pension funds, to enrich himself and others. Recipients of Teamster pension fund loans included Marcello and Trafficante, and the latter shared an attorney, Frank Regano, with Hoffa. Kaiser points out that Regano later said that on July 23, he met Hoffa in Washington before leaving to see Marcello and Trafficante. Hoffa gave him a message to take to the Godfathers. Hoffa wanted Regano to tell them, "Something has to be done. The time has come for your friend, Trafficante, and Carlos to get rid of him. Kill that son of a bitch, John Kennedy. This has got to be done. Be sure to tell them what I said. We're running out of time. Something has to be done." According to Regano, he delivered the message, and the two men looked at one another in icy silence and did not respond. Of course, by that time, Marcello and Trafficante had already been carefully planning JFK's murder for at least 9 months. Regano later wrote that he didn't take Hoffa's demand seriously, but Regano's behavior in the fall of 1963, including publicly toasting JFK's murder with Trafficante on the night of the assassination, and, as reported in an FBI file, handling a huge sum of cash for the assassination, indicates that Regano played a larger role in JFK's murder than the attorney ever admitted. Johnny Roselli was also feeling pressure from Robert Kennedy in the summer of 1963, since RFK had targeted his boss, Sam Giancana. The attorney general pushed to get Giancana at any cost, according to mafia prosecutor William Hundley, who would later learn of Roselli's confession to JFK's murder. In the summer of 1963, Hundley represented the Justice Department at the Chicago hearing on Sam Giancana's lawsuit to end the devastating lockstep surveillance the FBI had him under. To stall the government's questioning of him, Giancana apparently helped leak a story to a reporter with the Chicago Sun-Times, which ran an article stating that Sam Giancana had done work for the CIA, helping the agency with intelligence related to Cuba in 1960. The newspaper item didn't mention assassination, but it did reveal the October 1960 bugging incident with Giancana and singer Phyllis McGuire that had involved the CIA. The article produced two major results. First, Hundley had to back off from questioning Giancana during the court hearing for fear he might reveal the CIA mafia plots, which RFK had been told had ended the previous year. Giancana won the suit. The ruling forced the FBI to stay farther away from him. Even so, RFK